that little movement, which is destined to become big, because it's the right thing at the right time, I believe. Because to be a peace church is to rediscover and embrace the way Jesus spoke about power and the methodology he used to challenge injustice and to be a peacemaker. He said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." That's a very active word. And it means that we are proactive to do what needs to be done for peace in the world. In every church, a peace church, we have a slogan or a motto which says the church could turn the world toward peace if every church lived and taught as Jesus lived and taught. Now, I said yesterday that not many people believe that, probably because we have abandoned Jesus' understanding of power as nonviolent power and have shifted more to the empire's understanding of power, which is power as domination, coercion, and homicide. But for the first 300 years of church history, the church did live in the power of nonviolent love of friends and enemies. Then came the Emperor Constantine and the Edict of Milan in 313, which gave Christians official recognition and acceptance in the empire. And that was a new thing. They had been a forbidden religion and outside of the structure, totally outside of the structure of imperial power. So we're asking this morning, was this legitimization of, pardon, is it on? Everything is on. Are we not getting sound up there? Pardon? That's on. Does it make any difference? Okay. Well, the Edict of Milan, which legitimated Christianity under Constantine, the question is, was that a good thing, or did that do something other than good for the church? Out of that union of church and state came the practice of infant baptism. So then everyone born in a Christian family in the empire was automatically, without any choice on their part, baptized as a Christian. So the thing changed, whereas for 300 years, people had made a choice to be baptized. That was a decision to follow Jesus. Now it was an automatic process. Well, to go into this now, I'd like to look at the question of power, and we're going to have conversation here. I'm not going to talk the whole time by any means. Let me ask you, what is the motto of the U.S. Army?
Be all that you can be.
Is that right? That's what I understand. Be what?
It's an army of one.
An army of one. Is that the new motto or something? Okay. I'm going with the old motto this morning. Be all you can be. Parse that a little. Talk about that. What is implied in that? Character development?
Individualism.
Individualism?
In the army, I don't think so.
Self-development.
Self-development.
We're the plan that can make you all that you can be.
Right.
Okay, all that you can be as what?
Well, I would say that unless you, but you're not all you can be unless you're out being trained to kill people.
Well, that's not an extreme interpretation on the face of it. That's what the enterprise is there, right? So be all you can be is associated with becoming a warrior.
But it's a seductive
Sure.
That is the implication. You're nothing now, but we'll make you something.
Okay. So. That wouldn't work. Learn to kill wouldn't work very well as a slogan. But at the bottom, it's kind of a definition of human achievement and in fulfillment, heroism. This be all you can be as a human being. Now, I'd like to go from that to this book by Jonathan Schell titled The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. How many of you have read something by Schell? You know his name? He wrote The Fate of the Earth on the nuclear threat. That was 20 years ago. He is... he writes for things like The Nation, The New Yorker, Harper's Atlantic, Foreign Affairs. This book, I think, is really destined to be important because it looks at all of history, and it starts out with a question of two paradigms of power, two notions of what power is. And I want to read the first two paragraphs of the book, of the introduction, a good place to start in a book, I think. And he wrote this on December 17, 2002, and the title of his introduction is The Towers and the Wall. He's kind of conscious that he's writing in the wake of the fall of World Trade Towers, and then the wall is a reference, I believe, to the Berlin Wall. So let me read these paragraphs, two paragraphs. Of arms and the man, I sing. So wrote Virgil, celebrator of the imperial Rome of his patron, Caesar Augustus, in the opening lines of the Aeneid, as rendered in the 17th century by Dryden and memorized by generations of English schoolboys who were soon sent out to rule an empire even more far-flung than Rome's. The man, the phrase again, of arms and the man, I sing. The man, a patriot, bound to fight and perhaps to die for his country and all that it possessed and stood for. Arms. The means whereby the man could vindicate his honor and defend his country or aggrandize its power and interests. The fighting man took life, but also was ready to lay down his own, thereby bowing in the mayhem of war to a kind of rudimentary justice. Four centuries before Virgil, the Athenian statesman Pericles, much admired in both imperial Rome and imperial England, eulogized him in his funeral oration for the soldiers of Athens who had died at Marathon. As for success or failure, Pericles said, they left that in the doubtful hands of hope, and when the reality of battle was before their faces, they put their trust in their own selves. And in a small moment of time, the climax of their lives, a culmination of glory, not of fear, would be swept away from us. That is, they would be swept away from us in the climax of glorious war. And so they would be accorded, quote, praises that never grow old, the most splendid of sepulchres, not the sepulchre in which their bodies are laid, but where their glory remains eternal in men's minds, always there on the right occasion to stir others to speech or action. End of quote. On these foundations was reared a system at its best of standing up for principle with force, right with might, at its worst of plunder, exploitation, and massacre that would last from Pericles' time to our own. That's the end of the first paragraph. Yet alongside the martial tradition, another contrary one was born, almost at the very moment that Virgil was writing his lines. Jesus, the New Testament says, was speaking the even better known words, put up thy sword, for they that live by the sword shall die by the sword. Following in the tradition of some of the Old Testament prophets, he sang of the man without arms. The sword in question was no symbolic weapon. It was the disciple Simon Peter's sword, and he had just cut off the ear of one Malchus, a servant of the high priest, who had been in the act of arresting Jesus in Jerusalem. It was in the heat and fury of this bloody altercation, not in the quiet of the philosopher's study, that Jesus gave his advice. And these words, too, took root somehow in people's hearts and lasted down the centuries. So you have there two visions of human greatness, the Aeneid of arms and men I write, and Jesus, put up your sword, for whoever takes the sword will perish by the sword. Well, and what were some of that? That was sort of Jesus saying what not to use for your method. What did he say you should use as your method?
Love.
Love your enemies. Love your neighbor as yourself. But it goes beyond loving your neighbor. To love your enemies. And he also spoke of commandments. What did he say about in the Gospel of John? A new commandment I give you. Love one another as I have loved you. And how did he love us? Well, you can get into that. It was a self-giving love. Well, what are your thoughts now about this tradition of Aeneid on the one hand, the Aeneid, and of Jesus on the other? How have these impacted the church specifically? How has the church played out these two traditions? Bifurcated. Could you say a little about the bifurcation? Okay. More comments about how that process went. What do you think was in Constantine's mind whenever he did what he did?
He wanted to reunite. He just wanted to unite everybody. He wanted peace. He wanted the path of least. It seems like I am reading a book about Constantine. I was so excited to see this thing on. It's just a very small part of history, but the book just talks about how he wanted to, okay, what's the easiest thing that I can get to bring the Roman community together?
Okay.
And he wanted the easy way.
Okay. Yeah, Constantine's vision. Comments on that?
Well, you know, I think that there probably was considerable impetus for him to do that as a result of his mother. His mother was a staunch Christian, and I think that she influenced him a great deal. She then established or tried to in all the different places where the potent events of Jesus' life occurred. So when you go visit the Holy Land now, these are the places that she established 300 years later.
That same thing. She had a lot of influence on him, and she did a lot of traveling back and forth to Jerusalem.
Okay.
Helena.
So he became some kind of Christian. Go ahead.
According to the tradition at the time, you did not have to become a Christian until your death, so that you could live a sinful life, a wonderful life, so and then you could become a Christian. And this was Constantine's path, and he deserved becoming a Christian to the end of his life. So there's been some mixture. Was he really a Christian?
Okay. Anything else? As an emperor, did he have any other interests at stake here?
He wanted to establish a new world order. His whole life was the military squad with conquering and killed part of his family, made sure his wife was better. He did not live a Christian life at all, but he was very interested in unifying the empire, which had been divided into four sections by military conquest, gradually unified the empire. But then Christianity was allowed to be not an outlaw religion anymore. It was the largest religion of the empire by that time. And then the Christians started fighting amongst one another over the doctrine that they wanted to make sure that the Christians were small and were unified also. So he was interested in theological or religious unification as well as other political.
Okay. Back here. Well, yeah, we could talk a little about that. Were the Christians a threat? I'm not sure if you read our discussion yesterday. Jesus came proclaiming the kingdom or the kingship of God. Was that a threat to other kingships at the time?
Some perceived it.
Was the perception just a misperception, or was it a fairly accurate perception? It'd be accurate. What, so how do you mean? What, why?
Because I think that a Christian's allegiance is not to an empire, but to God and God's ways.
Okay. And how about their method of being in the world? Their allegiance is different. It's their method. How do we deal with enemies?
Yeah.
How do empires deal with enemies?
Yeah.
On the face of it, you've got a conflict here. And the emperors who saw a conflict, I think, weren't just misperceiving things. They were perceiving things pretty accurately. The Aeneid back there and Virgil were about something different from what Jesus was about. Now, was it a case of... Well, you could just neatly parse this up. You could have this and you could have this, both sort of on parallel tracks. So you're suggesting that was Constantine's enterprise.
That was Constantine.
We can't beat them. Let's join them. Let's co-opt them. Let's get them to think they're doing the same thing we're doing. Let's circle around this idea of unifying things a little bit, Constantine wanted unity. How much unity did he want? Who did he want in the union?
The entire previous Roman Empire, since it was split between Rome and Constantine.
Okay.
When it came through the other religions, of course, when Christianity became a state religion, Constantine and his army took the temple away from the pagan religions and gave them to the Christians. And so the Christians all of a sudden had property and wealth and prestige and power. And the only way you could defend the world, the only way you could defend your property and prestige and wealth was through violent power. So they had property.
Okay, they became. So the unifying was unifying the power of Rome and the Roman Empire. So you had a good definition, shall we say, of the insiders, but then sort of everybody was new, or at least Rome would tell you who the outsiders are. And so the enterprise is to defend the insiders against the outsiders, and to do it with dominating force, superior power. How does that compute with Jesus' new commandment, love one another as I have loved you? An imperial Rome. It's useful for us to think about Rome today as an empire. And I heard an army chaplain from the U.S. Army War College talking about Pax Romana and Pax Americana. And he likes Pax Americana because he thinks Pax Romana was a great thing. This was the glory of Rome and Christianity. And so he thinks... You know, what's going on today, Pax Americana, is more of that good stuff. What do you think?
Poppycock.
Poppycock. Yeah, and the decay within the Roman Empire wasn't just sexual immorality. It was also trust on homicidal violence and war and militarism to sustain one people against another people. That was part of the rich against the poor. Kaplan. Was that it? Go ahead.
I think so. And we should accept that. We should act like an empire. And the examples he gave, the Roman Empire and the British Empire. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like, get over it. If you object to this, this is the fact. We are an empire and we should act like an empire.
Yeah, that's Robert Kaplan in Harper's.
Kaplan, yeah. Did you say?
Robert Kaplan. And I think it is a very important article. Yeah, I saw it. It was in a chalet up here, but I had it at home. Yeah.
This idea of Pax Americana has been showing up on the internet on sites like MoveOn.org and Common Dreams, Truth.org, and not in that way, but in the opposite way. We have to be very, cognizant of what's going on, and that we are. I mean, it isn't just defending what we already have; it's advancing.
Yeah, I read that and I say this would be great satire or irony, this guy. Yeah, right. Truly frightening. And yet, there's an interesting thing, and I would like to talk with people about that article. He doesn't expect it to last all that long. Did you notice that?
He says, well,
Okay, is that sort of what he says? It's going to happen, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I guess.
Who says democracy is right for every place?
Well, this man deals with democracy. He talks about the modern democratic revolutions. And on the whole, I think the notion that the people ought to speak their hearts and live their truth, if that's democracy, then let's nurture that. Let's see that happen. Kathy's note that there are other voices in the media, important voices, saying that this empire is something to be watched. It can be dangerous and so forth. And there are new possibilities. And I want to move to new possibilities about empire. And I just want to read the closing sentences of his introduction in this book. He says there's been a lot of war in the last century and a lot of death, as you all know. So he says it's difficult to make out, even in the distance, the outlines of a world at peace. I shall contend, nevertheless, that quiet but deep changes, both in the world's grand architecture and in its molecular processes, have expanded the boundaries of the possible. Arms and man have both changed in ways that, even as they imperil the world as never before, have created a chance for peace that is greater than ever before. To describe those changes is the business of this book. And he stands at an interesting place to deal with all of this, because the man is not, you know, he's not a professing Christian, not a professing atheist. He understands all kinds of religions and systems, and he just works through it in a very, very impressive way. And one of his powerful arguments is that the war system, and specifically the nuclear terror system, it's not a workable system. And if you want to talk realism, what might work, you have to get beyond that pretty soon, real soon, because that's not working. And so I think as Christians, as believers in Jesus, we ought to be rapidly ridding ourselves of these realist arguments that claim to take the harsh realities of the world seriously, and claim to make the case that realistic people will see it our way. And one thing that Shell does time after again in this book is say that history has trumped the theorists. The theorists said such and such isn't possible, and he shows you where it happened time and again. The overthrow of the Soviet Empire, what happened in the Philippines, the freedom struggle in this country, the end of slavery. I think there was, before I move on back here.
Yes, just going to make a comment about, Bush and Constantine.
Yeah, yeah, that would fit.
They both use their surroundings, the people and their systems, and manipulated them so well. For example, Bush has been talking so much about democracy, but yet in the Democracy of the United Nations, when it doesn't follow the way people
Yeah, we could spend the rest of the morning talking about parallels between Pax Americana and Pax Romana and Bush and Constantine. Just before we move to a next stage of the discussion, I just want to return to the mention of the text, a render to Caesar that which is Caesar, and to God's that which is God's. The church has learned way too much of the wrong thing from those stupid words, I would submit to you. It would just take a few seconds to parse that, to think about the language. When Jesus said, render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, what kind of a ring did that have in Jewish ears at that time? Caesar. Give me some modern parallels for a name in the world that would have a sort of the kind of ring that Caesar's name had for them.
Saddam Hussein.
I wonder. Why? Why do you?
Well, only that Caesar was the enemy to the Jewish people, the oppressor.
Yeah.
Caesar also was God. He regarded himself as God. He was a deity. So my interpretation of that is that if you think Caesar's God, bow down to God, render to that God. If you think this is God, or the Jewish God is God, then you need to not be on have a clutch allegiance to the other God.
Okay. Gary's got basically an all or nothing thing there.
And whether you are going to worship Caesar or you're going to worship God.
Well, you may be right on the all or nothing interpretation. I'm going for at least this much. That Caesar and God were not 50-50 in the ears of those people. They weren't two equally valid names or realities. And when Jesus said those words, phew, it was more of a question than an answer. It just sent those people hustling to think, well, what in fact would be Caesar's and what in fact might be God's. And it wasn't a quick little formula for giving Caesar whatever he wanted and God whatever was left.
I was focusing on two different things, one the spiritual and one the political.
No. Go ahead. Say a little more.
And that's my interpretation.
Yeah. And I want to hear you talk that out.
Keeping peace politically, but preserving your focus for your spiritual life to God.
Yeah, and I don't. We have to disagree on that, and I think we ought to talk about our disagreement on that, because what Jesus proclaimed was the kingship of God or the reign of God. Now, was that a spiritual term or a political term? Kingship, kingdom. Is kingdom on the face of it? What kind of a term is it? Let's start with it, what it is on the face of it, and ask ourselves why he chose a term like that. For what?
It's an analogy.
Okay. We're back to the question of whether, when he proclaimed the reign of God, the kingdom of God, that on the face of it constituted a threat to other reigns or kingships.
They didn't understand his analogy.
So, then, my kingdom is not of this world.
Yeah. But did he say my kingship is not in this world, or did he say it's not of it? He said it's not of it. And he was talking about the character of the thing. Where does it arise from?
Well, the word world could possibly be interpreted as this culture, not necessarily the whole cosmos in that sense. And that would lend the same interpretation. It's the same place you're going, I think.
But yeah. What does world mean there? My kingdom is not of this world's values, its definitions of power, its way of trying to run human affairs. My kingship brings to this world another definition of power, another way of running things. What does the Lord's Prayer say to us about what are we to say about kingdom according to the Lord's Prayer? Can you spiritualize all of that? Is that all spiritual? The prayer for the kingdom to come and God's will to be done. Can you do God's will on earth spiritually? And that's the beginning and the end of it. So we're praying for this reign of God to come on earth, and God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. So I just submit to you that when Jesus used these words, the kingdom of God is at hand, the reign of God is upon you, it's among you, he chose a very political term, because he was about to implement, he was demonstrating with his life and teachings a different way of being in the world and of organizing human community, a different form of power, which functions by embracing the circle of humanity. Love your enemies, don't set out to destroy them. I think you can read the whole biblical story as a story about what to do about enemies. And the whole Bible doesn't say the same thing all the time about that. The Old Testament, it's annihilation, annihilate your enemies. Then there's separation, separate from your enemies. Build walls, keep yourself pure, keep the outsiders out so you have the inside. Separation, very big in Hebrew history, in Israel's life. And what did Jesus say? You have annihilation, you have separation, you have reconciliation. Reconcile with your enemy. Love, overcome evil with good. So those are three very different ways of thinking about what to do about enemies. And I don't think the church's task is to just decide, well, at one time we'll use one method, and another time another method. Or the state does it this way, and we do it this way, and both of them have their sort of equal place. One's as good as the other, just as long as we know which to use when. History is conspiring to show us that they're not, the extremes of this, the annihilation and the reconciliation, are not equally useful or realistic ways of dealing with human problems and enmity. Maybe you need to stretch. We have what, 20 minutes yet? Are you cold? Are you warm enough? Stand up, everybody. But just stand up. Get on your feet. Move your limbs a little bit, and we'll transition. I have the luxury of moving around, and keeping warm. And then we're going to look at a phrase here, slavery. What does that bring to mind? What content can you give to a phrase like that?
Exploiting other people.
It would be exploiting other people. When you think of slavery, you think of exploiting.
Well, it could be near slavery, or it could be righteous slavery.
Okay. You could, righteous slavery could be justified slavery, or mere slavery, only slavery. what if we change the word slavery to war? And we say just war. Are we saying mere war? Just war. It's just war. It's just war. Justified. The church would move light years ahead of itself where it is now, I think, if it just started using justified instead of just. When it talks about war, justified war, there's an active process involved here. It's not a obvious given. It's a process that happens when war is justified. What I'd like to do is take a page now off of the website of Every Church at Peace Church, and I have, I guess, two handouts this morning. And this will be one of them. It's an essay by Dr. Carol Hunter at Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. And her title is, Does the War System Depend on church support. And she wrote this last summer, actually, and I'll read at least part of it because I want to give you this idea and then invite your discussion of what she is saying. After visiting a church Sunday where my husband and I kept silent protest during the congregational singing of both My Country, 'Tis of Thee and God Bless America, I decided to celebrate this 4th. This was 4th of July last year, by rereading Frederick Douglass's rather famous speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July? Given in 1852. The whole text, 20 pages, is available online, gives the URL for the online version, and is a stirring critique of the rhetoric of political freedom and natural justice, quote, which brought life and healing to you, but stripes and death to me, unquote. After scathing expose of the internal slave trade and the recently passed Fugitive Slave Law, 1850, he gets to a very sobering point. The church, he claims, is responsible for the persistence of slavery. He writes, quote, it has shamelessly given the sanction of religion and the Bible to the whole slave system. They have taught that man may properly be a slave, that the relation of master and slave is ordained of God, that to send back an escaped bondman to his master is clearly the duty of all the followers of the Lord Jesus Christ, and this horrible blasphemy is palmed off upon the world for Christianity. End quote. Douglass quotes Albert Barnes, abolitionist author of The Church, Bulwark of Slavery, who says, there is no power out of the church that could sustain slavery for an hour if it were not sustained in it, unquote. The historical force of this idea is staggering. My dissertation field is 19th century abolitionist history, and all the evidence I have read forces me to conclude that Douglass is right. Slavery could not have been sustained without the support of the church. And that brings me to the present. Militarism, as the U.S.'s policy, can only be sustained as long as the mass of churches support it. Less than 5% of the churches in Douglass's day were anti-slavery. I'd guess about the same percentage today are peace churches. The numbers are so low in part because we have been conditioned by economic, political, and nationalistic forces as much as religious zeal to read the Bible in such a way that it is easy to make a pro-slavery or militarist just war and holy war argument. Same goes for anti-woman and homophobic arguments. I have spent hours reading 19th century sermons that supported slavery, citing Abraham, the Levitical law, Paul, and more. I am currently reviewing notes to Exodus and Deuteronomy for a colleague, and one can't escape the command to go in and possess the land, a huge source of contemporary biblically justified violence, both defensively and offensively. So she's saying, she studied all the arguments in the Bible, from the Bible, for slavery. She finds herself also looking at all the arguments in the Bible justifying war, and she finds disturbing parallels. Let's talk about all of that a little bit.
Huh. Could I just comment one thing that I heard shortly after the vote was taken by Congress to approve of Bush's omnipotent powers to go to war at any time, that the Black caucus in Congress voted against it in mass, in total. And I've never seen that since, or heard that since.
I wonder why.
Which leads me to believe it could be true. Uh-huh. And if it is true, it speaks very strongly, I think, to what we're saying here, that the minority, the Black caucus, is very aware of the slavery issue and the war issue, and that they're the ones that suffer disproportionately.
Is that true? Can anyone verify?
I remember hearing something about that,
Caucus. Now, isn't that amazing? That all these Congress people rolled over. But the Black Caucus.
Verify, Mike. Isn't that interesting? That none of us knows.
Yeah.
There's a white group sitting here.
Yeah.
We don't know how the black.
Shows that racism is intimately connected with the war effort and organism. You know, in the Vietnam War, black guys would refuse to fight sometimes because they say, ain't no D.C. ever called me no nigger. Why am I fighting for white American value and capitalism when I'm the one who oppressed that home?
Yeah.
But
yeah, the V.C. Or so it seems. There are blacks who are telling blacks that that's also a myth, and it doesn't work like they say it works. It's not as neat a door out. It's more like a trap door.
But the rest of society.
Oh.
So you could justifiably bring the parallel between exploitation via surgery, and this particular war is one of exploitation.
Do you want to say a little more about the surgery analogy?
Well, I'm talking in answer to the black people being against the war in Iraq as a group, because they perceived it correctly, I think, as exploitation of this country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the things happening in the African American communities in Florida, where they were severely disenfranchised. And now the community is very active in voter education and voter education and pressing for voting correctly, because of course the ones that don't vote correctly are in the poor community. So there's a very strong
Yeah.
I think this goes back to where you were. I think you have to really work hard to make the scriptures justify war or slavery. And it's a total misinterpretation, but it can be done very easily. And it has been done easily, and it has been done culturally, with culture. So I won't say more than that.
Well, say just a little more about how this justification is done, you know, practically, the justification of war. In scripture, how's it done? Okay, you take a little piece and generalize and say that describes our situation. We can do the same thing, huh?
Or else you can take a whole culture and take portions of it and try to reculture it. We're trying to enculturate that in our setting as well. And in fact, we wouldn't want to take the whole culture. We want to just take the portion
the piece of it.
So, and really, that's not a proper use of the scriptures.
Okay. Other comments on the scripture? I think our task today, I mean, if there was a task a century or so ago to deal with slavery in scripture, that the church had that task. I'm suggesting that the church has a task to deal with the violence question and the war question, the homicidal power question, this notion that you secure the world by the selective killing of people, that we have an interpretive task. In our time, and how do we work at it? How do we work at it? What books, have you found helpful?
The pre-Christian scriptures were changed completely by Jesus. We listened to the Sermon on the Mount, says 5 times or something like that.
words that of old, I cannot choose the truth. I say to you, it is that we've heard it said of old, love your neighbors, but hate your enemies, but I say to you, love your. So you kind of change this. So we can't be fundamentalists and biblical inerrantists about the war issue in the Old Testament. And Jesus forbids violence, starting in the New Testament.
So.
Jesus
is our guide in challenging things that you can find in the Hebrew Scripture. Our authority for challenging those things is Jesus. That's the way I was. And I will point out this book again, which I think I mentioned yesterday, Jack Nelson Palmyre's book, Jesus Against Christianity, Reclaiming the Missing Jesus. And one of the... pieces that I was going to read from today and didn't get to, but I'll just read a little bit because it deals with Constantine and it deals with the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' teaching. What have we done with Jesus' teaching? Love your enemies in the Sermon on the Mount. This is by a Baptist, Glenn Stassen. Some of you have heard of Harold Stassen. That was Glenn Stassen's father. And Glenn teaches ethics and biblical ethics at Fuller Seminary. And his title is High Ideals and Hard Teachings, The Church's Tradition of Evading Jesus. And he says in the middle of this article, then Constantine became the first Christian emperor, and the church trimmed off whatever might suggest criticism of Constantine's way of ruling, including justice and peacemaking. In the 4th and 5th centuries, the church councils defined Christianity in terms of some doctrines stated in abstract Greek and Latin terms. Larry Rasmussen writes in his book Moral Fragments and Moral Community, A Proposal for Church and Society. Some of you surely know Rasmussen's name. He writes, the disabling and ultimately tragic development is that the focus soon shifts from Jesus and the particular way he incarnated with his community, the way of his God, shifts from that to the metaphysical relationship of the individual figure Jesus to the church's God, now become also the empire's God. In the most un-Jewish of all possible moves, the Jew, Jesus, became a detached Jesus in the hands of the great ecumenical councils. He was detached from his own historic community and its way. And that word way is so important. It's the way to live in the world. Not the way to get to heaven, but the way to make it through the world and the way to make human relations function. To have a sustainable human community, not the kind of human community we're looking at today, which is driving our children mad. And they ought to be mad at us. We've had 50 years of a country that has terrorized the world with nuclear weapons, justifying it from top to bottom. It's been illegal to stand against that terrorism, ask the Berrigans. Go to jail for standing against that terrorism. And we act or think our children shouldn't be much affected by the prospect of no future or the prospect of a nuclear future, a blown-up world. This kind of toxic national policy isn't supposed to drive our children mad. There's hope in the fact that they're angry, depressed, mad, striking out. At least they see that something is wrong while we go along as if, well, this will work, you know, just give it a little more time. It's not working. To conclude, just the comment from Stassen here, the further thing he says about the Sermon on the Mount, he moves beyond that to the Apostles' Creed, and that's what I wanted to read. Where is that sentence? I recently went to the Medieval Art Museum in New York City in the cloisters. The beautiful paintings and sculptures there depict Mary and the baby Jesus and Jesus on the cross. The tapestries there do include a few incidents from the life and parables of Jesus, but there was little from what happened between his birth and his death.
It's like the Apostles' Creed and the comma, quote, born of the Virgin Mary, comma, crucified under Pontius Pilate. All of Jesus' prophetic teachings are hiding behind that comma, unseen and unheard. And so we hardly know why Jesus was killed, because we've passed over his life and teachings, and we don't spend time there. So that's, again, that's why every Church of Peace church says the church could turn the world toward peace if every church lived and taught as Jesus lived and taught, which sends us always back to looking at how Jesus did, in fact, live and teach. I'm passing out here a page that's about how to get involved in building a peace church. And this material is basically taken from the our Every Church Peace Church website. We've worked primarily with the website, but we're starting to get some more hard copy too. And we have about 150 pages in this manual. And I'm going to place this over in the fireside room. I think you'll be able to find it over there. If you just want to walk in sometime and just page through and see a little more of the resources. Again, basically all taken from our website, ECAPC. And I just want to mention the four themes on this page. It's all about building community. First, partner. Find one other person. Don't try to work alone. Second, unite. Form a small group. Call it an experimental peace church. Be the reality that you want to create. Whether it's 3 or 10 or 12 people, create that subversive community that lives the new way of Jesus. Third, grow. Schedule public events. Don't get locked into this little community. Always have something happening where you're in your community, you can invite people to come and watch video, discuss an article, explore what it would mean to be a peace church. And finally, the fourth, the big one, transform your local congregation into a peace church. So we try hard things too in the church, huh? Be all you can be. Transform your church into a peace church. Yeah.
Not germane for this, but something that bothered me about in Romans, Paul says to one of your enemies, because that will heap burning coals upon you. So now we're using love as an instrument of revenge.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple possibilities. There's a possibility that we don't understand all of what heaping coals of fire meant. There's also a possibility that that's one of the places Paul was less than fully redeemed, which is a possibility.
There were a couple places.
Yeah. Yeah. But he also did some useful things for us. His whole, Paul's the guy who said, The powers that be are ordained of God. And Romans 13. But I invite you to look at the context. Start in chapter 12. Go on through Romans 13. That chapter break is one of the most unfortunate chapter breaks in the whole Bible, I submit to you. But I will suggest that it comes, submit to these government authorities, the powers that be. It comes in the context of Paul's teaching that you do not use violence against your enemies, against others. You overcome evil with good. And then he comes to the really big test, the powers that be, the empire coming at you. How do you deal with that one? Well, you have to submit in some sense. You don't strike back. Their instinct was to fight the empire. We read Romans 13 and we see American flags everywhere and we think how nice it would be to submit and to be able to cooperate with this power. When Jesus said submit to the powers that be were seen as a great test case of the evil power coming at you. How do you deal with evil powers? And so Jesus say, overcome evil with good. Love is the fulfilling of the law. That's where he ends up in Romans 13. Well, our time is up. I welcome you to stay around and talk, but you need to go if you need to go.
I feel like there's something. Just let me go over the list one more time.
Talk to the pastor.
Check. Announce your engagement. Check.
Reserve the